What is it like to be a black face in a white space? And when I talk about white space, I'm talking about an academic space. That's what we're going to talk about tonight on another episode of The Eight Black Hands. Stay with us. Welcome, friends and family. After that big pump up music, we should all get up and do a little dance, but we're going to hold off and not do it tonight because we might break something. Some of us are old in this joint. And by that, I mean Sharif. Tonight, yeah, we get the grayness and the beard. So you earn the gray and the beard. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's not given. You know, you earn it. That's why we bring these young folks definitely on our given show. To be able to talk the good stuff. So tonight we thought we would entertain you with a little bit of fancy book learning from us by bringing on a guest for once. Yeah, a well-read, well-written, well-studied, well-respected guest. And apparently, I don't know if this is true or not. I'm about to say it and act like I know what I'm talking about. But is he in the same frat brother thing as you? No, y'all in different ones? Oh, okay. All right. I thought you was a guy.
First fam. Throw it up.
Yes, sir. Okay. All day, every day.
We show love on this podcast. Right, Reeve?
Tall. It's not like
games. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes you be hating on the other bros, but it's all right.
This is true.
I've heard true. We have receipts.
This is true. And some of the sisters, too. But anyways, we're going to keep going. Mm-hmm. Our guest tonight is Dr. Back all the way up. I don't know if you like to be called doctor, but I call people doctor on the first run, but you will let us know what your situation is. Dr. Frederick Ingram Jr. is with us tonight. He is a professor and an author and a radical ally on the Twitter spaces. He be in the Twitter streets and all. So he's not just one of those academics that writes books and then gives lectures and then shows up and bores you half to death with some dumb stats that you've heard before. He actually takes it to the people. And what do we love here on this show? We love people academics. We love the people's scholars. We don't love the scholars who like do it for themselves. And Ray, you know what my thing is. You're on the PhD track. You know what I say. I like it when y'all go and you come back and you bring something to the people and you treat that like a communal degree, like it's owned by your people. I don't love it when y'all go and come back confused. Dr. Ingram, welcome.
Say, make it plain. I love folks who make it plain. They got the make PhD. It plain. Make it plain.
Man, yes. Come May, I'm not even going to know none of y'all.
What are you even saying right now?
I mean, I defend. I'm
now, is this May 2023 or another May?
23. I'm compartmentalizing y'all and like, yeah.
You can't do that. That's not even cool. Not even a little bit cool.
That's exactly the type of boy he was just talking about. Right. You just said that you're gonna be with the other group.
Oh, I didn't.
Yeah, you did.
Listen, so let's focus, man. We got an esteemed scholar on board tonight, and we want to talk about his research. We want to talk about the upcoming things. You got a book coming out this year, right, sir?
I do.
Yeah. Mm. So what are you working on? Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, we will get to the book because you know everybody got a book. And we will get there. We on the way to the book. And we will probably even give away the book. Oh, by the way, bookmark right now. I'll just stop for a second. Friends and family who have just joined us, we try to give y'all books. And we have book giveaways, but y'all hard to work with sometimes. I'm just going to be real with you. Now, when we tried to give away four of Dr. Kamiko Royal's book, we told y'all, call us and leave us a voicemail message. And the first, I want to say five, will get a copy of her book. Some of y'all, it was the first time you ever left a voicemail message. And the hard part is you didn't leave any information in the message. So how are we supposed to get you a book? Phone a friend. Okay, for some of y'all that are not old enough to know how voicemails work. Anyways, I only say that to bookmark. We are still going to give away
people Dr. Kamika Royal's books.
We are still going to give away these books. Ray, if you can put our phone number into the comments section. Folks, look for the phone number in the comment section. First five people that call us.
I don't know the phone number. I'm not your intern. I'm talent. What the hell?
I'm trying to give my people literacy. And my people keep fighting me. They keep fighting me on giving them some literacy, even on the show here. Anyways, we will get it up. We'll get the phone number up. First five people to call, leave a message with your contact information. We will send you five copies of Dr. Kamika Royal's book. And by the way, when Dr. Ingram's book comes out, we will do the same thing for the doc's book, and we will have him back. But anyway, sir, welcome to the show. One of the things that actually had me want to find out about you was that we interact on Twitter. We see each other on Twitter, and I saw you on Twitter. But you wrote this paper called "Move." We don't need to convince you that our oppression is real. This isn't exactly like yesterday. This isn't a new, but it was. It's not a new paper, but it was so good for now, for right
timely.
Now. Timely is what I needed to read right now. So I want to talk about anything you want to talk about, but I do want to start with this, the theme in your paper about being a black face in white academic spaces, because that was one of the things that rang out to me in what you wrote. And make it real for us and make it plain. Like, what's that one about? Why did you write it?
I think for me, I think it's one of the things that I think as black folks, particularly those of us who don't fall under the guidelines or believe in the politics of respectability, I think that there is always this feeling of othering, right? Like, I think we're, as black folks or people of color, are othered in general. But I think if you also do not follow what everyone says you're supposed to do in academia, what you're supposed to be as an academic, you know, you're not supposed to say certain things and do certain things. You find yourself existing in a space sometimes by yourself when you thought that there would be other people standing there with you. But I think one of the things that really reminds me of that is like just being in different spaces. Like, for example, in my last academic appointment, I made history coming. I was the first ever African-American, first ever person to be jointly appointed in a criminology and African-American studies appointment. Although I am a higher ed scholar, my previous degrees are in crime law. And so that's where that connection came from. Because my work is for the people, African-American, specifically black folk, there was that the marrying of those two worlds. And I think a lot of people like to have us because it looks good, like the first ever, or we like to put people in space for the performance value of it all, right? But we don't really have any real good intention of actually supporting the work and actually being part of the disruption and actually giving space and support for people to be able to do that work. And I learned very quickly, like within my first month, how performative that experience was going to be and also how rough it was going to be. And so I had two options, really, and it was either you go with the flow and tuck your chin, tuck your head and just, you know, don't make any waves, or you go the opposite way. And if you follow me on Twitter, you know, I'm always going the opposite way. And I think for me in that particular space, even in that particular time, when I wrote Move, we were, you know, it was like on the heels of the murder of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor. And what we see is the performance of DEI. We see this performance of people pretending that they care about us. We saw 2020 with everybody when they got their certificates because they read a certain book, right? They put their little black boxes on Instagram and they did all of those things that gave them some street cred in the anti-racist movement, right? And so as a result of that, you had all of these people like, you know, trying to give like awards to people who did like the bare minimum. Like a certain coach of a football team in Alabama like walked with his players at the front of the line while they were protesting on campus. And everyone was like, oh my God. And I'm like, bro, y'all really applaud anything. You know, when we got the Juneteenth ice cream, the Juneteenth napkins, the Juneteenth plate, that was like, when they start painting streets, you know, Black Lives Matter streets, people was like, look how far we've come. I was like, I will knock you in that paint.
So two things. One, you missed it last week when I talked about how much I love going to Target after Black History Month the day after, like March 1st, because you get all the like the Juneteenth-ish type of t-shirts and everything for like $5 and $3 and whatnot. So when you just said Juneteenth napkins, I have some in the basement from JCPenney after Juneteenth is over, clearance rack. So anyways, I look super woke at home. The second thing is you gave it to liberals in your paper. Like, and you said they're performative. Mm-hmm. This thing you just said, even just now, about them getting certificates mm-hmm. and whatnot. Now, I don't want to dissuade people from wanting to get, you know, training, DEI training. So how do you do both? Anyways, fellas, jump in here. I just want to know how you do, because if you're a white liberal watching this right now, you're probably going to get frustrated because it's like,
when you were at UT Arlington, right? Mm-hmm. The governor, piece of shit, Abbott. How were you dealing with that? Being a black professor in your space, dealing with all the things that you have to deal with in terms of like just being in the rooms of academia and then just processing everything that was going on down there that was anti-black. And then what advice do you have for folks in Florida, for folks in higher ed in Florida?
Yeah, bro, it was super rough because one, I never saw myself in Texas, right? I just didn't see myself there, but I was one of the academics, the people who graduated, and we graduated right into a pandemic, right? And so I graduated in 2019. I was like the last class to be able to have an actual commencement and be able to walk. And then the following year, the cycle that we would have been on the market for, we go straight into a pandemic. And so I was lucky that any university was hiring, let alone a Research One university. And so because of the way things were, I kind of didn't really have a choice. I had to go. And so the process, I went through the interview process, they put all the black folks that you could meet in the space. And I remember asking during the interview, like, is it really this black? Because when I'm Googling, I see a lot of black people, right? And I see a lot of black folks. Y'all put all the black folks from the closets to put them on this search committee. But is it really this black when you get there? And one of the women, full professor, Dr. Bell, actually was like, actually, it's not. It's funny that you called it like right away. And I was like, I tap into the performance immediately. But one of the things I think made it rough is, as a critical race scholar, there were all of these initiatives to ban literally everything. And so I'm teaching, you know, racism and anti-blackness, and you know, in a state institution, I'm teaching a massage war, I'm teaching about you know, systems of oppression, I'm teaching about these things, full knowing that it could cost me my job, right? And did not care. I'm like, you know, the work of disruption is to disrupt. And so although I knew what he was doing, I knew the lieutenant governor had essentially made it a plan to not give tenure to anybody who studies critical race theory and trying to like revoke our appointments. But one of the things that people don't know about Texas particularly is that the things that Florida is doing is kind of like you see it. So if you opt to go to Florida, right, like that's you're choosing that, right, where you're seeing it. Texas is a little bit, I think Texas has one of the best PR machines on this side of Mississippi. But I say that because most folks don't really understand how violent that experience is until you're there. And so I think people don't realize that the bulk of black professors and faculty in the state of Texas, a lot of them aren't even tenured or tenure street, right? A lot of them are in contingent positions, they're in non-tenure track positions, and they're there. So a lot of them can't buck the system because that means unemployment. That means not being able to, you know, get another job elsewhere, particularly if you've built your life and everything in Texas. So I think what I say for anybody, particularly those young and early scholars, emerging scholars on the market, like, please do the work of understanding where you're trying to go and like what that means for either supportive measures for your identity, sexuality, sexual orientation, gender identity or non. What does that mean for you to enter into those spaces? Because, you know, I was telling somebody the other day, I said, with all of the job, with what we're seeing happening in Florida with the violence every single day of Governor DeDummy, you have that going on, right? But you also see all of these academic positions open. They're hiring for critical race people. They're hiring for people studying, you know, Afro-Latino work. They're hiring people currently for this. So how are you hiring people for disciplines that you are actively pushing back against? And so when you look at that as someone who's like, you know, you got to have a job or I need to get a job somewhere, it puts you in a predicament where it's like, I don't really know where else to go. Maybe a Florida school is the only school that granted you an on-campus interview, and you feel like I have to go there, but then you're walking into a very violent situation. So a lot of people don't really understand how difficult it is in academia, getting a job, getting an interview, getting on-campus invite, and then let alone an actual appointment. There's a lot that goes into that. And so you really have to factor in how important is my voice, how important is my fight. And that's what makes a lot of people go into the be quiet until you get tenure space, right? Because then you can be able to talk about what's going on. But then those people, once they get tenure, they've been so quiet for so long, now they want to tell you how to be good. They want to tell you how to get tenure. And part of telling you how to get tenure is telling you, like, you know, don't ruffle so many feathers, right? Like, don't call out so many things that I'm like, do that, you know what I mean? And if that means that I never earned tenure, then I've made peace with that, but I can't be quiet about it, you know?
Yeah. It does seem like with all this stuff that has been going on in Florida and other places, that a lot of these super radical white liberal professors who taught whole classes on revolution this and Che Guevara and blah, 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 just fell down like big dummies. Mm-hmm. Like the, you know, the Governor DeSantis comes on the scene and they're just like, oh my God, wow, what are we going to do? I guess I better mm-hmm. shut up now.
Yeah.
I guess I better like just, you know, go ahead and get this pension. Mm-hmm. Well, wait a second, bro. You've been teaching for years. You've been teaching all this like radical revolutionary weather underground, blah, blah, blah. But when the revolution came from DeSantis, you was like,
man, they took all those posters off the wall.
All of them. Quick.
They're like,
Quick. Delete.
But that's the beauty of whiteness, though, right? That's the beauty of whiteness for them, because they have the ability to be able to just take the posters down and no one knows.
Blend right back in. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And what they, and that's mm-hmm. the, and that's why I ride white liberals the way that I do, because they don't understand that, like, you have access and privilege that regardless of what happens, you could move to another state, right? Dye your hair another color and become a whole nother white person. You know what I mean? Like, we don't have the ability to be able to disappear and blend in like that. And so that's why I detest the term ally. And I'm like, I only rock with co-conspirators. I need to know how much you're willing to give up, how deeply embedded in the fight for liberation you are. And a lot of them, you know, when I was in New York last week on the tour, and someone was like, yeah, we were told not to say white supremacy because it empowers white supremacists. I was like, no, you were told not to say white supremacy because they don't want you to name the thing that identifies white supremacists. You know,
and I mean? And like one of the first functions of sanity is calling things what they actually are.
Absolutely.
It's like the way that you start knowing you're sane is you call mm-hmm. things exactly what they are. Mm-hmm. Do you think that they have so poisoned first of all, let me back up. The goal of the right is to poison the brand of CRT, poison the brand of critical race theory, make it seem like some weird, so off the deep end type of philosophy, make it toxic so that nobody even, you know, wants to go find out what it is. Do you think that they have succeeded to making it so toxic that it is hard for academics even to attach themselves to it anymore?
Absolutely not. I think it only does that for people who don't read.
That's all of America, bro. That's like all of them. That's like, that's, I mean, like
look at those guys.
It's like 7/8 of America. 7/8 of, like, 1/8 of America still reads.
A week. Well, who are the white dudes? They call themselves the good liars or something like that. And they go around with the camera and they be interviewing folk. Like, what do you think about critical race theory? I hate it. Well, what is it exactly?
What is it?
I don't know.
You know what I'm saying? And so one of the things, like, for me, I'm actually guest lecturing on Friday for a colleague class about race, racism, and critical race theory. And one of the things I said was, show of hands in here if you know what critical race theory is. And a lot of them raised their hand. I was like, great, now explain it to me. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when you do that, all the hands begin to disappear, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm like, you know, mm-hmm. foundationally, like, help me understand where, you know, what it is. And they were like, you know, it's about racism. Yeah, but it goes a little bit deeper than that. And I want you to be a little bit more intentional in the words that you use and how we describe things, right? Because they are calling it racism, but they're calling it reverse racism. But we need to understand that critical race theory departs from a lot of early, you know, critical legal scholars in that space for a very obvious reason. And it's the same reason that performative white liberals are able to hide, because they don't want to name the things, right? They were like, let's talk about discrimination, but the word race and racism was a bridge too far, right? And so what I try to get people to understand is that, like, us identifying and directly naming the way that the law foundationally directly attacks, minimizes, subjugates African-Americans, Black folks, is not, you know, reverse racism. And I was like, I was like, you know, so understanding from that core concept, it easily gives you a way to understand the way that they take terms and flip them, you know, for their own good. But I think for those of us who are like legitimate CRT scholars, like it hasn't moved us at all. If anything, it's provided more, it provided us more content to write about.
Mm-hmm. It's like reinforcement 101, right?
It literally is. It's like what's happening right now?
Racism. They're like, no, that's not it. Here's some new policies and stuff that doubles down on it. We're just like, This is when Anchor be on there like this, right? Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So it's like, what you're doing right now is proving the reason why we do this in the first place. So I definitely think I've been in conversations, even in Black educator groups. I don't know if y'all are in them Black Facebook educator groups,
you know, Anchor,
talking about that we don't even need to mention. Where they talk about it, and I've heard people be like, why do we need a theory to talk about race and racism? And I'm like, bruh, don't we got the Big Bang Theory? Don't we get that theory? Don't we get the theory of dinosaurs and everything else? We have theories for literally everything, but the one that talks about how you are directly impacted is the one you don't want to hear about? You sound like people, you know?
That's like the Candace Owens of academics.
Right. Don't do that. Don't do that. one thing I want to say, and it's interesting that you made that point about CRT and its focus, is that, you know, you're starting to see in higher ed, like most of us that are coming through the pathway, we don't have dissertation chairs like you or like race scholars as dissertation chairs. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my first iteration of my dissertation, critical race theory, was my framework. Mm-hmm. But I had somebody that didn't look like me as my chair, mm-hmm. and they weren't having it, right?
Yeah. Don't tell me you backed down, bro. Don't tell me on this show that you backed down.
I went through 6 months of fighting to keep this thing in my dissertation. I have all the research that led up to it, but I had to end up using Black Masculine Care by Professor Bass down at North Carolina State, in order to get through to where I am now, you know. But like, you know, there's a lot of sacrifices that we have to make coming through, given how much highlight is being put on CRT. What are your thoughts on that? What kind of guidance can you give to doctors?
That's actually a really good point. I think one of the things I've seen, particularly for Black doctoral candidates, I remember being on the committee last year, and a Black young woman scholar, she was talking about the experiences of Black women in, you know, who are on the rise toward being presidents of institutions, particularly white institutions. And she was using certain explanations and contexts and to name it. And one of the women on her committee was very adamant about her not saying certain things and doing certain things. And how do we know this? And how do we know that? And we had to pause for a second. And I'm like, you will never be able to relate to what she's talking about because you are a white woman, right? And so what I told that student, I said, now go back and I need you to write this exact thing in your dissertation. Say, this is not for white people. This is for us. And sometimes explain for them because they got to read that. Now they got to respond to that, like a pleasure moment. But for me, when I was a doc student, one of the things I did was I was very clear that I was going to have an all Black committee. And because of the way that I operated within my program, that was going to be always going to have an issue. And so I knew that I did not want to deal with a white voice telling me what way I should approach my study and what theoretical framework was going to matter most, because I had already decided for myself what it was going to be. But I think a lot of us, particularly in these white institutions, get stuck because it's like, I want to get out. And I don't want to get held up because of the fact that my chair and I, or my advisor and I'm a mentor and I, can't seem to get on the same page. So a lot of us end up, you know, giving up that small fight to be able to get out. But you could always get back to it once you're done. The dissertation is only a part of your journey. It's not the end of your journey, right? It's just the beginning. And so I think for a lot of people, like, you know, don't feel defeated, right? If that's what you got to do to get through it and get right back to what you wanted to do, once you are able to have your own voice, return to your own voice and put your own work out, you can return to that and write about that person that oppressed your voice while you were in your program. But I was very clear for me. I was like, I only wanted Black women on my committee. That was the first thing. Mm-hmm. I wanted no black men. And the reason for that was because I felt like all of the brothers that I had as faculty were, and this is going to sound crazy when I say this, but they were pushovers. I watched how, and they were pushovers for this reason. They're black men. And in that space, they didn't want to be seen as hostile. They didn't want to be seen. And so they gave a lot of space for my white colleagues and classmates to be able to feel like they could make it through the program. But different people like me who came in prepared and ready to, you know, let's get dirty. I felt like I was being shortchanged in a lot of those spaces because they had to handhold my white peers who were not prepared wholly. And I was like, nah, I need somebody who was going to, like, you know, hold me accountable. I need somebody who's going to make sure that I do this and I do this right. And so all the black women professors I had were like that. And I ended up having a black male chair, Dr. Williams. He was phenomenal. He was phenomenal for me. And then my, you know, Dr. Munir Morris and Dr. Cheryl Holcomb McCoy rounded up my committee. But I was clear that everybody had to be black. Everybody had to be black.
This is what I find ironic about that. You know, I want somebody to write a book or a paper on what I'm about to call the white override, right? Which means, like, the white power in America is to always be able to override the other the races. Mm-hmm. So if we have a dispute in America, mm-hmm. and people have different opinions about a thing, mm-hmm. the one who calls it, the ref that will call it, is the white override, mm-hmm. right? So if we have an argument about what should be taught in schools, the white override will decide it.
Yeah.
Right. If we have an argument about who should get a PhD, the mm-hmm. white override will decide it. Mm-hmm. If we have an argument about what is scholarship, the white override is the ultimate referee in the United States. It's the referee behind the referees, all the referees. And we know this, right?
Mm-hmm. Their whiteness outranks everybody else. Yeah. They like, I'm white.
How many black governors do we have? How many black senators do we have?
Yeah. Yeah.
How many black federal judges?
Are we counting Tim Scott as black?
Never. How many black judges did Trump appoint to the federal benches? Right.
Right.
So when I talk about the white override, mm-hmm. this is an experience white people will never have. They will never have an existential feeling of, I've just got to suck it up to get through this program to get on the other side because all these black people are about mm-hmm. to override my decisions. Mm-hmm. So I need to just, so then. There's a few things, feelings that happen beneath that. Even if you do it just to push through, you're mm-hmm. starting to accumulate some resentment and some Absolutely. Hostilities that you're going to carry with you. Mm-hmm. Even if you do it to get out, yep. right? You know, it's the white override.
Yeah.
That's an experience tree. It's a tree because, you know, things will grow. Fruit will grow off of that tree.
Yeah.
I'm having this experience. You're not. Mm-hmm. So here you are walking all around, you know, balls out, you know, commando everywhere you go. You don't have no, you don't have no fear, no care. You don't give a damn. But now
I disavow from this talk. I don't know what's happening.
What? I'm just, listen, there's a way in which what the doc just said was you have black men who don't want to be too aggressive. Mm-hmm. You got black women who don't want to be seen as the angry black woman. You have people who are trying to go through these programs and they know they got to suck up some stuff just to get through it and get out the other side. Right. And they got to put their pride in their back pocket and they got to wear that. Even mm-hmm. as they're writing about liberation in their dissertation, they're having to put their liberation in their back pocket.
The liberation through the lens of the white people who read it too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then also in thinking about the white people that's reading it, you also have to language it in a way in which they understand it. So now you have to co-opt how you write in order for them to be able to understand what you're writing about.
Listen, and I think as long as your liberation doesn't make them feel uncomfortable, you're good.
That's the thing. That's the thing you just mentioned right there. It's like it's this whole aspect of, and I say this all the time. I say it in class when I'm teaching. I make it plain. I said my work isn't in making white people, the majority, comfortable. I don't really care about their comfort, right? Mm-hmm. I care about liberating the oppressed. I care about giving space and voices for those who have not ever had a chance to have their voices heard. And if you feel that me saying that I don't care about the majority or I don't care about, you know, centering white people, then you are the issue, right? And I don't have to make space for your feelings in that regard. I'm not finding ways to oppress you as the individual, but if you are leaning into your whiteness needing to be sent, or if you are leaning into like your voice as the thing that matters most in this conversation. As we talk about liberation, I'm not the space for you. And I tell people that all the time, like when they invite me, I'm like, don't ask me to do DEI talks if you got to give me a disclaimer about like, don't say things that are going to offend people. Or we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. I'm like, I do DEI talk and I do true talk. And if that's not what you want, you need to call somebody else, right? Like straight like that. And for that reason, what you just mentioned, I actually have a paper coming out next month called Y'all Don't Hate White Supremacy Enough For Me.
That should be the book.
Because it's right, the book. It talks about this. It talks about how we even perform and lean in and bend to the needs and desires of white people and whiteness, and always giving them the space. They always, to your point, they always win. They always, when things are uncomfortable, it is them who get, we have to cede to them. We have to cede black children being able to see themselves, and children from Native nations being able to see themselves, and queer children, trans children being able to see themselves in the literature, because the white kids are uncomfortable, right? I'm not doing that. You know,
the white kids actually uncomfortable, right? Like, because there's a whole lot of folks speaking for white kids,
right?
You know, who may not necessarily in that conversation, or what I think in some, you're going to see in some waves where they actually become more interested, right? Yeah, like every time you talk ish about Malcolm X, his book sells more. Every time you talk about like CRT, people are going to start looking it up, right? Because you can't crush every single thing, right? Like my mom used to say, stop calling it white supremacy, because in their head, even when they hear it, it reinforces to them, like, yeah, I am supreme, you know, like stop my supremacy. When she was like, it's actually white savagery. Even when they're not killing your kids, they're killing your ideas, they're killing your culture. They, you know, to make you shrink. That's a savage mindset to try to destroy anything else.
It's not to be seen. Love causes spirit murdering, right? And so I think you make a really good point too. But I think one of the things I'm seeing too are white students definitely want to learn. Like the number of white students who come to me, like the paper that I'm putting out next month about Y'all Don't Hate White Supremacy Enough. There's a white student who was on that with me as second author. Like she came to me.
We just gotta raise them well.
Yeah, you absolutely.
And they just need to raise the white kids well. We adopted parents.
Yeah, she came to me at the class and was like, "Hey, are you doing anything? Because I'm really interested in the work that you're doing. I'm really interested in what you're talking about. And is there anything that you have going on that I could jump on?" I just got this paper, approved, and actually you could help me with this. And so they definitely want to learn. I had, at my guest lecture Friday, another student came to me and was like, "Are there any recommended readings? You know, is there anything that you think that I should be looking at?" So they definitely care. They are definitely moving
a lot of them.
And they're causing fear, though. Yes. This is where their grandparents are starting to be afraid of like the woke kids.
And that's coming home
for Thanksgiving. Absolutely. Well, and just I'll tell you this, Doc. So two things, like one, number one, always make sure there's a second person in them rooms when they're coming up to you asking you that stuff, right? Like, hey, is there something we can work on, whatever?
You need to bring a wine with you too. You know what I mean? Just like, beep, 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 beep. Right, you know what I mean? Like, all right, now we can talk. You know what I'm saying? Just
talk real loud.
Listen, just be careful.
Talk loud. I am talking to you about academics. Just talk loud. So if there's anybody around, so other people.
You know how them cops be telling us to stay still, stop resisting when you're already dead. And they're like, stop resisting. Like, just be loud. Make up stuff for the camera. Make up stuff for the recorder. You know what I mean?
Doc, I want to show you something. I want to show all my brothers here something. This is the craziest thing. Now, y'all know I like to find crazy things. You know I like to find crazy things and bring them up.
You found a crazy hat for the show today. Like, you find them.
Listen, it's called cultural appropriation, right?
It's cultural appropriation
101. Except for we invented farming. So, anyways. I find crazy stuff, and then people think, oh, Chris, you're lying. And then I said, I'm not lying. I'll show you the article right now. And this is your fault, Doc. I just want you to know it's your people with all this stuff y'all write about, all this race stuff or whatnot, that's causing this madness that I'm about to show you right now.
Okay.
Bill in Montana would ban teaching of scientific theories in Montana schools.
Well, how the fuck
the bill would call for not teaching anything that's still a theory. You could only teach scientific facts. So, Ray, from your party, some Republicans sat around and thought this was a good idea to write up a bill that would become law. This is the level of mediocrity that rises through our power systems, first of all.
You don't see the play here. You don't see the play here, sir.
Tell me what the play is with this. Tell me what's the end goal with not being
labs in Montana.
That's hard science.
But I want to ask Doc, listen, seriously, what's I'm a layperson, what's the consequence of this type of thinking?
It's a strategy that's always existed. Even if we go back to like the creation of race itself, the divide and conquer strategy, right? The strategy that we use all the time. Not we, by me, I'm talking about them people, right? It's the strategy that they use to keep us, you know, separate. If you look at Robber's Cave, right, from that strategy, you look at the Stanford experiment, right, and we can swap all of those things out and replace with Republicans and the Democrats. And if we replace, you know, that with the, you know, the poor white people and the rich white people and the proletariats and the bourgeoisie, right, there's always, you know, a this side and a that side. And the core tenet of all of those things is the strategy of divide and conquer. We always have to have somebody feeling like, and by somebody, we mean the majority, and majority meaning white people, right? That they're always feeling like they are in some way in control of what's happening. Because this whole thing is about social control. It's always controlling the ability for us to move, the ability for us to control our bodies, the ability for us to reproduce, the ability for us to work, for mm-hmm. us to experience mm-hmm. joy. That's mm-hmm. what all of this is about. So if they can figure out ways, minimal ways, maximum ways, for them to be able to control those things via dividing and conquering us, then they've succeeded, because we spend more time arguing about what we actually meant than actually focusing on the fact that this is a distraction, right? And mm-hmm. we have a purpose for what we're doing, and we can't get buried in the weeds with these things. I saw a bill the other day that they're arguing about allowing for, I think it was toddlers to be able to have firearms. Like, are you kidding me, right?
people are batshit, right? And this is their brightest. This is the brightest. Yeah. That this is like right. their, right. like, wow. you know, these like, the people that this determine, is who we're giving all the power to. Yeah. Yes,
these are the people that determine whether or not you or I are considered, you know, important or whatever. The things that we do are worthy of praise. These people.
But this is where the cancellation, I mean, what'd you call it, Chris? The white cancellation?
The white override.
The, yes, white override.
The white override.
And this is where it comes in, because the ones who actually know that, they're like, yo, that's batshit crazy, but you know what? We can further this agenda anyway, right? Like, they know, mm-hmm. like, you know what? That's out mm-hmm. of bounds. That is nuts. That's too far. And I'm going to use them as a blocker and just block, you know what I mean? Like, let them go a little bit further. They're advancing.
I think the worst thing we could ever do is misjudge, miscalculate their actual intelligence, right? Because it's actually on purpose, right? Like, they don't, like, even with the guy that was running in Georgia, right? The football player with the CTE that he needs to get diagnosed, right? That man, right? Y'all know who I'm talking about, right? Mm-hmm. Even with him, they didn't care how terrible he was. That didn't matter to them. They just wanted to win. And they've said it.
Exactly.
They said, y'all are worried about morals. Y'all worried about putting, you know, the Dems will send their people packing if they even had view porn one time in 1972, right? They will send them people packing. These people are like, we don't care about any of that. We just want to win. And so mm-hmm. we are over here battling, right, morals and ethics with people mm-hmm. who just want to win at all costs. And you can't fight with people like that, right? Like, they're the people that when you come to a street fight, you're like, we only throwing hands, nothing else. And they're like, yeah, just hands. And they pull a baseball bat and knock your ass out, right? Like, it's one of the things that you have to be aware of. And so you got to be like, okay, I'm not going to get into the weeds of that. I'm not going to allow that conversation when someone comes to my talk and raises some ridiculous question or provides another ridiculous counterpoint. Like, I'm here for this reason, and this is the purpose. And you gotta know your focus, right? You can't allow them to provide the distractions and then lean into it.
It's the Al Franken theory of moral superiority. Yes,
absolutely.
I wonder though, like, you know, there's different degrees of which Black folks are must succumb to the white override, depending mm-hmm. on how educated you are, where you live, what you have in your background. Now, mm-hmm. bougie beige people listening to me right now, I'm beige too. I'm not saying this to like pick on y'all and be like, you know, like say you don't have troubles. I'm mm-hmm. just saying that there's some people that just can't say F it and mm-hmm. speak their mind at their job tomorrow. There's going to be people who wake up and go to a job tomorrow yeah. where they can't do what I could do or you yeah. could do or yeah. any of us could do in a way. They're going to have to suck it up, and they're yeah. going to be pissed off about it. And you know, the thing what Baldwin said about, like, you know, to be, you know, Black and aware yeah, in the United States. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Right. Like, and you know, is to be constantly enraged or whatnot. Mm-hmm. So how revolutionary they can be. And I wonder when we teach kids, when we teach young people about how they're going to have to move and work in this world. Mm-hmm. how we balance the reality that some of them are not going to be able to be full revolutionary all day, all times, with wanting them to be full revolutionary all day, all time, right?
Yeah.
Like what do we teach to prepare people for the reality, not for the utopia?
One of the things I always talk about is that everybody has a role in our fight for liberation. All of us, every last one of us, right? But what your role is differs, right? Not everybody is meant to be a foot soldier. Not everybody is meant to take everybody's soldier. Not 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 everybody's
soldier. Damn, this brother got bars.
I was like, what's that? Chicken.
What is happening? But yeah, you know, not everybody is meant to take to the street unless they boots up. Not everybody's going to throw that brick first, right? Some people are meant to be the driver. Some people are meant to be the person that pours the milk on your eye after you get pepper sprayed. Some people are meant to be the people that come and bail you out of jail. Some people are meant to be the people that make the repass, right? Like, mm-hmm. Everybody has a role in liberation, and the role that you have is figuring out what your role is, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, maybe your work is to be on the ground so we are fully aware of what these people are saying and what they're teaching at the lowest levels of government, the lowest levels of anything, really. And we need those people. And so those people, the foot soldiers, right, the people who are the grassroots folks, right, they need to be the ones to be aware of what's going on so we can get this word passed all the way through to the levels of high government. But everybody has a role. And I say this to my students, I'm like, even you as a white person, if you consider yourself to be on your journey toward anti-racism, you have to care about what's happening to the marginalized. And more importantly, none of us who speak English here have escaped white supremacy, right? Mm-hmm. And understanding that, like, particularly for those of y'all who are Italian in this country, mm-hmm. those of you who are Irish, those of you who parents came with the second wave of immigration, like, y'all all battled white supremacy, right? And mm-hmm. the fact that you consider yourself white means that your family lost too, right? Mm-hmm. And so getting them to understand at the most basic level, you know, is how we're able to educate
folks. Well, I just want to correct the record. They lost potato famines and rat infested houses in a former country, and they gained the world. They gained access to free labor and the benefits of free labor and everything. So it was a pretty good deal. It wasn't a bad deal.
Right.
You know, if you think about deals, they didn't really lose. Ray and Sharif, I'll kick this to you because this is kind of like the same question, but it's about parenting. Like how you teach your young people in your own life, your own house, the realities without scaring them to death, without like, you know, having it be doom, you know, all day. Like, yeah, listen, I saw a clip of Sharif's daughter. She was like, just telling him, you ain't talking to me right. You talk all nice to mom, but you don't talk right to me. And he's like, I don't, for real? And she was like, and I'm like, she fighting the power from the get-go, from day one. She was like, she's like, you talk nice to mom, but I don't like the way you talking to me.
Listen. I mean, you always talk about like free range kids. Like they are definitely, they are definitely that. But I think any of that type of stuff takes practice. And we talked about before, like, you know, legacy parenting and what it means, or when we're like so shook about, you know, for our kids' lives that we'll beat them half to death so that they aren't killed. You know, and like what that does for our children. Right. And so like we're, you know, like I know some family even now who'd be like, yo, that was back to that 4-year-old was back talking, you know, and I'm just like, they're like, I actually want to hear what she has to say. You know what I mean? And the fact that at the end, when I asked her, like, how should I talk? She said, think about it. You know what I mean? Like for her to hit that as she's going up the stairs, like, yeah, I want you to, you just think about it. Like, I'm like, yo, you 4, but like, yo, that's kind of dope. I'm glad you're telling me, you're challenging me from basically from your perspective, but like you're voicing how you feel. And I think that's a part of, you know, how we have to do. We have to, you know, like, obviously, you know, help our children understand like respect and honor, you know what I mean? Like, you know, what does respect mean? But also that they deserve respect too. Like, it's not just, oh, when you get gray hair, oh, now we're going to bestow respect on you. It's like, no, as a human being, you deserve respect, you know? And I think that's a big part of it. Just like, how do we, you know, raise our children in a way that doesn't, you know, you're talking about spear murdering and like, that ain't always just outside. You know what I mean? Like there are plenty of folks who talk about, and even now, like when I hear, and we, you know, we've done a show on this, I'm not going to go too deep on it, but when I hear adults, you know, speaking wistfully about, you know, beaten half to death,
yeah,
And then say like, I'm okay. And I usually am like, no, you're actually not. You just don't realize you're not okay. You know, and then pass that on. And, you know, if we keep telling them stay in the box, stay in that little tight box, that's what they're going to hear the rest of their lives. So mm-hmm. when can they be free? Well, you know, if it's not safe for them to be that at home at some degree, at school at some degree, it definitely ain't safe for them to be out there. So where do they actually learn how to be free? Where do they practice even mm-hmm. a part of that mentally, intellectually, spiritually, emotionally? Where does it happen? And if we can't provide that kind of safe space in our own community and space, like, man, like we're doomed. Because in order to be a freedom fighter, that means you have to think freely. Mm-hmm. And if we're telling them, stay there, be quiet, don't do this, or just commands, when do they begin to think about it? You know, what Alejandro talks about, birds born in a cage think flying is an illness. Mm-hmm. We do the same thing. We bring them and raise them in a cage. Don't move. Don't do this. Don't that. We're going to the supermarket. Don't touch. Don't ask questions. Don't talk back. And then it's like, hey, you need to advocate for yourself. When did I learn how, mom, dad? When did I learn how? You smack me every time I try to advocate.
A lot of us needed to heal our inner children before we actually had children. You know what I mean? One of the things I talked about last week in the talk was about how I was called mouthy as a kid. And it was I was called mouthy, but what it really was you were treating me poorly and I'm putting you on notice about it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't like how you make me feel. And because we are not used to kids having personalities and looking at them as whole people, right? We can't fathom the fact that a child knows when they're being disrespected, right? And the fact that a child would ever name that and voice that is too much. So instead of us acknowledging that space and apologizing, we'd rather beat that out of them. And those people then become parents and then continue that cycle, right? Which, to the point that you made, also adds to the spirit murdering.
Man, I tell you what. This little girl of mine, man, she's different. She got a quick tongue, and you ain't about to say nothing to her that she feels like is disrespectful, because if you do, she gonna call you out firsthand. She don't care who you are. She gonna call you out, and I love that about her.
Yes.
I was just with her just now, prior to the show. She was getting her hair done. We need to do an episode, because we all got daughters. We need to do an episode on the processes of young black girls getting their hair combed, man, because it can be brutal sometimes.
Yes.
And so she texted me. She was like, daddy. I was like, yeah. And she was like, I need you. And so I come down, and for her last two braids, I got to hold her hand because, you know, she going through it. And that's just the joys of being a dad, man. Just like watching your baby grow, watching your baby talk her talk and do her thing. And I tell you what, you're going to give these teachers hell. Not in the sense that she's not going to sit down. Yeah. And be smart and learn and do all the things that she needs to do. But if you disrespect one of her classmates, she's coming for you.
Yes.
You disrespect somebody that she's close to, or just you, just any child in general, if you treat them unfairly, she's coming to me with it, and she's going to tell me how she felt about it. And we're going to have a restorative conversation with whatever teacher it is.
Yeah.
This is where
seventh grade, y'all. I took my seventh grade teacher. Remember we had mediation? Growing up, I took my seventh grade English teacher to mediation because I didn't like how she talked to me. And what I later learned, that teacher was at my parents' wedding. So I was like, oh, so you know my family, you talking crazy to me. And that's exactly what I mean by the white people who decide which of the black people of us they're cool with. But they're not really about their liberation work. They're not really about being truly anti-racist, because you decided my parents were respectable, but me, the child of those same people, you felt you could talk to me crazy. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, I will say this, Doc, and every other doc listening, y'all got to stop writing these books that y'all be writing.
Why do you got to stop?
Well, just listen, because I know what's important. So I'm just going to say the important stuff, right? Like, I'm a lay person. So let me just like say what I say, right? I love y'all books. Oh, with all the jargon and the spirit murdering and we don't need no reform and all that stuff.
Uh-oh.
Which we do need reform, people. Stop writing these books, black academics.
Don't do that. We need
it's not one person. All of them start talking a language. Like, I'm working with somebody right now who I love, who is doing some great work for me, is helping me understand whole child learning, mm-hmm. and is writing all this stuff up for me. But I have to consistently say, especially newly minted PhDs sometimes are really off on some other people's language. I just don't always. I'm like, can you put that shit in a tweet? Can you please just like.
It's the mentors, though, because like my mentor was Claire. That's why I said I wanted black people, right? Like my mentor was like, write in a way that a grandmother in another world could be able to understand, who doesn't speak English, could be able to like relate to what you're saying. And even if we come up with these terms, right, but also define it in ways that that are lay so that they can, you know. So I use a lot of pop culture. I use music. I use TV shows, right? I use those things because they're for us and ways that we can visualize what, you know, theoretically I'm talking about, right? But that's how you know people who are actual good writers and people who just be writing. Because if you can't do that, you ain't a good writer.
And I just want to say this. Like, this is no shade on my people in one way, because I like to be stretched. As a layperson, I like you to make me have to look stuff up and think and whatever. I like that. But in this last conversation we just had, listening to Ray, listening to Sharif or whatnot, would be so much more helpful for me is not another paper or a book about a system, but a book about raising free people, right? Like, everything y'all just said, I thought this should be in a book.
Yeah.
Like, how do you raise free people versus how do you repeat the cycles that your grandparents gave to your parents that gave to you? Right. Like, my grandparents lived in a world in which Emmett Till taught them, yes, you do beat your child until, you know, so that they don't go down south for the summer and end up dead. Right. Mm-hmm. It's the Emmett Till thing of parenting, of like, you let that boy go down south. He didn't know how to stay in his lane and he got in trouble, blah, blah. Now you have, I grew up in the 70s when they were killing black kids in Atlanta, you know, for a period of time. And black parents all across America was like, you can't go outside. Mm-hmm. And you were sitting inside, like, just really like thinking that a LTD could pull up, Google it, young folks, you don't know what an LTD.
You know what,
a Ford LTD or a Mercury or, you know, like Cougar or one of these cars could pull up and you just be gone, right? Mm-hmm. Right, so now we're in a different generation. I'm watching Sharif's kids. They really are free people. When you see these videos of these little girls are the freest of the free.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, but that's because he ain't got no classroom management either.
They don't need to be managed. That's the whole thing. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's the one thing. Is like, people like want to over manage, over police. They just over police by police. They over-police by adults and just constantly on them. And all the time, like, just look at the research about like how many conversations kids have and versus how many commands they receive.
Yes. Mm.
So much of what they hear from the English language is commands. Yeah. Mm. Do, don't, stop, start all day long. Like, I mean, I get tired of hearing about it. Yes, they do. Yes. Yes, they do. Yes, absolutely. And guess what? So do adults. Well, everybody who's employed any adults know, like, you know what? Human beings do dumb stuff sometimes. It ain't just
kids. But we got jobs. So
some of them, a whole lot of folks get fired because of their dumb stuff, right?
I think you make a really good point, too, because I think particularly when it comes to kids, we spend so much time trying to get them to operate in a way that we want them to operate, like machines. And I think a lot of parents make the mistake of doing what white people did to us, treating us like property. You know what I mean? Like, I have this conversation often with my mom about, like, we are full adults, right? Like, talk to us like adults. Talk to us like full people. That were raised with good sense, right? And we can have a conversation, like, stop calling us the kids, right? Or these kids. Like, my brother 40, I'll be 40. My sister pushing up on 40, right? Like, we are grown-ass adults, right? So, like, talk to us in that way and we can respond accordingly. And I think most of us have taught our children well. So even if they fall and they mess up or they get hurt, like, they will learn from it. And you can't always protect them from the harm. You want to, right? But that's not the reality of it, because you create people who don't know how to respond or how to exist when they got to deal with conflict, if you're constantly screaming and yelling at them and not allowing them to learn and grow and explore. But not saying allow them to just do whatever, right? But also, like, allow them to grow into the people who they are intended to be, right? And provide them the support structure, right, for them to be able to be full people and to be them their whole selves. But I think for me, like, I don't have kids yet, but I definitely help raise nieces and nephews. And one, they do get on my nerves, but I appreciate having been able to have conversations with them where they feel like I'm a safe space and they can talk to me free as whole people, right? And even when they need correction and redirection, right? Like, they receive it from me because I'm not screaming and yelling at them all the time. I'm not screaming and telling them what to do or threatening to whoop their ass, right? So they have a way to be able to communicate. And when they're wrong, they know I'm going to let them right, you know, I'm going to get them right. But I think there's a difference in the way that we relationship versus the way their relationship with their folks.
Bro, so you grew up upstate New York, Utica.
Did.
Adirondack Trails, with Adirondack Trailways. That's right. That's on my path. I done been in the
streets. My mama is from Brooklyn over. Yes, sir.
Yeah. So explain to me this, man. Like, talk to me about New York education, like, and like what that meant for you in terms of just like the regions, advanced regions, and like how that put you in that. Yeah.
What I tell people all the time, so I was a young scholar, you know how we have these programs, these gifted and talented programs. I could talk shit about them now, but I definitely benefited from them, so I fully own that. But I was, you know, I was tapped for a program when I was like 11, sixth grade. So from sixth grade through my senior year of high school, I was in this program. I was in college from the time I was 11. Even before that, my mom, you know, my brother and sister and I went to college with my mom, went to class with her, sat in the back, ate our food and was quiet while she was in class with her classmates and earning her first degree. Being in this program, and part of the requirement of being in the program was that we had to do the Regents courses and graduate with a Regents degree or diploma and that sort of thing. One of the things I will say about, I feel like New York, I feel like I was well-rounded. And I didn't realize how well-rounded going to school in New York was until I went to school in North Carolina as an undergrad. We went to an inner city school. It was called an inner city school because it was mostly Black folk. And all the white schools in the suburbs were predominantly white schools. But there were a lot of things that we enjoy, right? That like people didn't, like I skied. I tell you what, I'm like, I skied in gym class, bro. Like I skied in gym class, bro, in middle school, right? We skied in gym class. We had a pool and like we were required to like be in the pool for like 6 weeks out of the semester, right? We swam, you know what I mean? Like, I was on the state championship, you know, track team. We had state-of-the-art, you know, things at the hood school, right? And it wasn't until, you know, I went away to college and was in this space with all these other amazing Black folks where I realized, like, yo, as underprivileged as our school was, allegedly, or as under-resourced as our school was and the space and all of that, like, we still had it better than some of our Black folks who went to school in the South, right?
Most.
They have gyms, right? I'm like, we have performance. I was like, we had to, you either played an instrument, you either was in a band, you was in an orchestra, or you was in a choir as a mandatory thing. And then schools that didn't even have performing arts. And I'm like, well, dang, what did y'all do? And realizing like just how wild the American educational system is for a lot of people. So it's a wonder any of us survived it. And even with all of the privileges that I say we had, we still, you know, we had cops in schools, right? Cops that carried guns on their waists in schools. And one of the cops that policed our school when I was in school ended up killing his wife and himself.
Wow. Damn.
Right. And so when you talk about what that was like, I was like, the school to prison pipeline, even though we had all of these benefits, was real. The military camped out in our cafeteria trying to get people to register for the military. And my cousin was one of the main people doing it. And so when you realize that too, like although we had these benefits, there were still... they thought less of us because the white schools did not have the cops. The white schools did not have the military in the cafeteria registering people. They were pushing them to go to college and they were pushing them to get it, you know, go on and take gap years and do all of that. Where with us, it was like, I remember a time where they pushed people out of school, kids who they didn't think were going to graduate, and they made them get GEDs and a very famous person from a TV show that many of us watched around 2006 that then became really famous was one of those people that got pushed out, right? And so you saw that happening, right? And so I thought there were some benefits to going to school in New York, but also now that I have the word and the language to describe that, like it was rough in a lot of ways for people who did not have the privileges that I did.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, bro. I think that that's super important. And then as I think about what's happening down in Baltimore, man, I feel like we need to celebrate more of our experiences, especially the ones that show that, you know, black kids can get in there and learn regardless of the circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when you say that about Baltimore, just for people listening, if you don't know, Ray had a successful TikTok video this week about Baltimore. And in Baltimore, you know, Baltimore has 100-something schools, and in 20-something of those schools, there's not a single proficient student in
math. Here's what they did, though.
This is why they got to get rid of the testing.
So, get rid of the testing, you ain't gonna, the problem goes away. I feel so bad about talking about Baltimore. Right? And the reason being is because I have a black superintendent, black woman superintendent who I adore, right? And so, and she's really good folks. But like, but here's the thing, like, here's what pisses me off. I cannot allow for folks to be like, oh, the COVID 2 years and kids couldn't learn during those COVID 2 years, when in fact I put things in place and my kids performed better. Mm-hmm. After that COVID 2 years, right? So it's like I can't allow for that. I mean, I understand that folks were under-resourced, mm-hmm. but like, if you knew going into the second year you need the computers, you need the laptops, and you didn't invest in your infrastructure, then how the hell can you blame the test?
Yeah.
Well, you know, and to be fair, because I, you know, you and I, we all know the superintendent. We know she's good people and she's working really hard. She's good with systems. She understands teaching. So you have to start asking yourself the question, what do you have? How do you have failure when you don't have a nefarious leadership and you don't have people who don't care? Because they got lots of good teachers in Baltimore right. either, or two. They got a lot of black educators there. So when you have a lot of the good conditions and it's still bad, you have to start thinking about some other things. What I came up with after seeing your video, I did a video, and you're not going to like this, but I get something of a response. And I said, this is what I said. I said, when something like this happens in Baltimore, you find out all these kids are not proficient in math in 20-something schools in a city like Baltimore. A person like me, who's used to kicking the school system in the groin constantly, and like, I always got, you know, I'm a reform guy, and blah, 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 all that stuff. I'm taking a different tactic now because the pandemic, for one, changed my politics.
Yeah.
Changed my mind on a lot of things, and it's this. It's all our fault that those kids can't do math. It's all our fault.
When you say all, oh, what do you mean? Because I ain't teach no math to kids.
So this is the first thing I said. The first thing I said in my response to your video, my video says, I'm the reason why black kids can't do math in Baltimore. We are the reason that black kids can't do math in Baltimore. It's not just, you can't lay it all on the teachers and on the schools or whatnot. Because even if they were all garbage, let's just say all the schools are garbage and everything's bad, your kids still can't do math. And there's these things called adults. And there's these entire populations of things called adults. And they're in your neighborhood.
Adults who can't do math, but go ahead.
Well, adults who run churches and adults who run, you know, nonprofit industrial complexes, and adults who are these things called parents, and adults who have access to libraries, and adults who have free time that they're using on a whole bunch of other stuff except for teaching kids math right now. If it really does take a village, then this is a village conversation right now. Because you know what? 10 years from now, the school system could still be failing.
You talking about these mega churches in your post?
Listen, I agree with you. And I do think it's a whole community. And don't forget, you started the show saying 7/8 of Americans can't read. Well, guess what? That number is higher for those who can't do math. So I don't know who's going to teach our kids math. You know what I mean?
I count myself in on the math ones, to be very honest with you, because I had a very broken math.
Listen, I shared this with y'all before. My sister, who was younger than me and was born in Iran, and you know, I used to tell people, like, I didn't see a multiple choice on math until I got to high school here. I just never mm-hmm. saw it. Everything was open ended. We're like, yo, this feel like cheating. Like, as a kid, I'm just like, is it okay to bubble this? Like, we had never seen it. So she wrote a blog about her experience and just saying, like, I never, like, just how math is taught is problematic here. You know what I mean? And so fortunately, she's a math teacher. She started teaching, wow. you know, using how she was taught math in Iran, you know, with her kids, and the kids were, and guess what? They did well on the test. Like, ooh, like they actually knew math enough to do well on the test. But I agree with you 100%. And we need some like adult, you know what I mean? Like the tutors have to also know the Sharif content.
Agree with you without agreeing with you. You don't agree with me, Ethan, 100%.
And I think Reef makes a point too, but there's an element that we also need to address too, is the way that black people's relationship with math is intentional, right? Like part of our dislike for it happens very early on, you know, in school for us, but it becoming difficult and to think about what jobs require us to know math and to know math well, engineering, STEM, those sorts of things. So if we have a lack of people of color, particularly Black people who are not good at math. We can make that a reason why we can't employ them, right? And so the systemic inequalities exist early on in math. And so we got to have people that teach math as a love language, right? Not as this difficult thing. And then we can grasp it a lot earlier and have a different relationship with it.
Yeah, I mean, Chris, really a couple years ago, you did this initiative, like you were just saying, stop telling people they're not math people, right? Like, I loved when I heard you saying that, you know, because I'm just like, I hate saying it, but I never really made it like a thing. And when you started saying, like, just publicly, stop telling people that, stop telling yourself that, I was like, yes, like, thank you, you know?
And Chris, I wrote a piece last week on that, that very thing, that as parents right now, and I'll send you the piece. I wrote it last week. Is as parents, as conscious parents.
I hope it ain't on Substack, man. I can't keep up with you.
No, I'll send it to you. You know, all right. The point of it was basically just to say, to be good for our kids, we have to get over our own stuff. So if we want to raise, if we want to raise mathematicians, we actually got to start jumping on our own, kind of filling our own gaps. Did you miss seventh grade? Did you miss a few key concepts? Did you miss something? When they come home and they show you that homework and you look down at it and you know this is going to be one of the first times that they figure out that you don't know every damn thing or whatnot.
Common Core, you don't know nothing.
There's some shame in that moment. There's a lot of shame in that moment. That moment is full of shame.
Yeah.
And what we got to do is we got to claim that moment and get over our shame. And we got to spend some late nights on Khan Academy and some other things.
That's what you got
to do. And on YouTube and lean into it. That's what we got to do. We got to lean into it.
Chris, go on to final thoughts, man. I'm trying to do some research to find out if Rihanna pregnant.
We're going to do final thoughts now at the end of the show with Random Ray. This is why we can't have nice things. But we're going to roll into
when Zora Neale Hurston used to shake her head after, like, that's the kind of folks you talk about. You know what I mean? My people.
This is the one that Harriet would have shot. So she would have shot his ass in Tennessee.
In Tennessee.
You ain't going to Chicago. You are not going to Chicago.
Oh my gosh.
No, Chicago is not for you. Anyways, so we're gonna wrap up final thoughts. We're gonna start with you, Random Ray, and we will end it up with Doc. Since
I yield my time to the scholar.
All right. Well, then we will go final thoughts with Sharif, and then and we will end up with Doc.
Yeah, Doc. Thanks for coming on. Appreciate you, and looking forward to your next book, because I do agree that people ain't mad enough. Some folks are sad. Some folks are just completely distracted, and some folks are gleefully ignorant and complicit, and at some point complicit, the people who are complacent and complicit become dangerous, at some point they become dangerous to the movement. So I think it's really important that we remain vigilant. Asada warned us about being comfortable with oppression, because then your body becomes accustomed to a warmer temperature or a colder temperature. And she said she described that as the same way that our psyche becomes accustomed to oppression. And so that vigilance that we need and that we have to make sure that our grandchildren have, and when I say grandchildren, not just talking about biological, I'm talking about like in our community, that next generation, like the students we have, we're really working and fighting and educating them on behalf of their grandchildren, because that's the impact that we have to have. So appreciate your work. Thanks for coming on, and keep giving them hell.
Absolutely. Appreciate you, man.
And my final word, going back to where we started at the beginning of the show, the phone number for the 8 Black Hands is 931-488-8898. Now, Ray said at the beginning of the show he couldn't remember this number. Look at all the eights. We are the 8 Black Hands, and this is the number full of eights. 931-488-8898. Intentionally with a whole bunch of A's in there. Ray, thank you for putting it into the comments for folks. The reason we give you that phone number, number one, is for feedback about the show, but also the first five people to call us, and one already called us during the show, by the way, the first five people to call us are going to get a copy of Dr. Kamika Royal's book. If you leave information of how we can reach you, please leave your email with us, and we will be in touch with you with that. And my final thought for this show with Dr. Ingram, just so everybody knows, this is Dr. Frederick Ingram Jr., associate professor at
assistant.
Tell him, big dog.
Okay, assistant
at that R1 Big Ten school. Tell him.
And some of us know what that means. And my phone is going ringing already. So that means somebody else is calling for Dr. Royal's book. But this is what I like to say, because, you know, I like things to be material and to be actionary. I like us to be to invest in the real movement and the real revolution. So when we have people like this that are doing the work, we know they're not getting rich doing the work. So what you do is you make an action step in your head. I am going to forego a Starbucks or a god-awful church's chicken meal or something like that, and I'm going to earmark that money for the revolution. So when this brother's book comes out, or when this brother has something that requires investment, he should be on your list, just like everybody else that we have that are doing the work, the scholarship, the intellectual work, the heavy lifting of that work that actually fuels revolution. Invest in it, real money. Everybody can be a what? Philanthropist. We all can be philanthropists. You all got $5, $10, $20, $15, $30 a month to be a philanthropist with. Buy a book. Right, to feel y'all read, and it shows. Anyway, so I appreciate you for coming on, brother. Please come back when you have your book or any other studies that you can bring to us. Thank you so much for coming on, and we will give you the final word tonight.
Absolutely. So one of the things in my book that's coming, Black Liberation Through Action and Resistance, move in the book with two love letters. The final one is a love letter to us all. The children of the diaspora. And one of the things I say is that I want us to love ourselves, because in us being able to love ourselves, we can truly work on liberating ourselves. That's all I got.
Oh, man, that's dope. Yo, that's brother, nice. He ended with the Soul Train sign off.
Ours.
And love. Like, all right. Well, fam, thank you for watching on another episode of the Eight Black Hands. We're getting dangerously close to the 200th episode of Eight Black Hands. We've been doing this for a minute now. For those of you that came, we know that there's a big important football game on tonight that you are
that Reef is watching right now.
That Reef is watching right now.
Seeing it in your eyes, bro.
You can't see anything in my eyes because I'm not watching it. I'm watching you. I'm seeing the light glow off that dome. That's about all you see.
Violence on the show. Again, here we go. Y'all so violent. Principal Cafele says that he was watching the Eagles get a beat down. So obviously things have changed since I have been on this show tonight. We have missed some things. But for those that who will watch it in repeat and see it later, we appreciate if you would share the show with friends and family. This is a Black father-powered education show, which is rare in education, and we hope that you get it to all your friends and family. Let them know that we are out here trying to raise 8 million Black children to their